From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The impeachment standoff continues between Democrats in Congress and President Trump and his Republican allies. Yesterday, the White House said it will not comply with requests for documents and witnesses regarding that July 25th phone call between Trump and the president of Ukraine. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says if the White House tries to hide the truth, it will be seen as evidence of obstruction of justice. Republican Congressman Mark Green of Tennessee joins us now. He's on the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, one of the committees with jurisdiction in this inquiry. Congressman, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Sure. And do you agree with the White House decision to ignore the House impeachment inquiry?
Yeah, I do. And if I could take a second and explain why. You know, every time this has ever been done in the past, it was initiated with the vote of the people by their representatives.
A full vote in the House, you mean?
Well, yeah, the full vote of the House. I mean, you can't initiate an impeachment of the president of the United States without a vote from the people. I mean, there's 800,000 people in my district in Tennessee, roughly, and they want a voice. And right now they don't. The Speaker of the House has commandeered the entire House of Representatives. It's insane to even think of it. I can't believe it's happening.
Okay, so let's say that Speaker Pelosi changed her mind and she did allow a full vote of the House and the House approved that the inquiry could move forward. Then what? Then do you agree with the decision?
Well, if there is a vote and if the process allows the president, you know, because right now the process, you know, he doesn't have a right to see all the evidence. He doesn't have a right to present evidence. He can't call witnesses.
Well, but, I spoke to a legal scholar about that this morning, that very thing this morning. And she says that this is a political process. This is not a criminal trial. The same rules don't apply. It's up to the House to decide how to do it.
Well, that's crazy. I mean, why would we ever extend due process to everybody else in America but the president of the United States? It is political. You're absolutely right.
If the president had nothing to hide, and he said that his call with the Ukrainian president was perfect, why not let the sun shine in? Why not let the American people see the documents and hear from witnesses?
He released the transcript, the next day? Let's make it a fair process, and I'm sure he'll come over. But right now, it makes no sense. It's a charade.
Well, the country has been here before. I want to play some sound from Senator Lindsey Graham, then a congressman, speaking on the House floor in 1998. He's calling for the impeachment of President Clinton and comparing Clinton's behavior to President Richard Nixon's.
The day Richard Nixon failed to answer that subpoena is the day that he was subject to impeachment because he took the power from Congress over the impeachment process away from Congress, and he became the judge and jury.
Congressman Green, do you agree with what your colleague said there, that failing to comply with a subpoena makes the president subject to impeachment?
No, I don't agree with that. And this is a president asking another president to investigate potential corruption. I'm completely okay with the president of the United States saying, hey, you know, everywhere Joe Biden went, his son got millions of dollars. Yeah, would you please look into this? I'm very glad he asked.
But it's not just Lindsey Graham talking about President Clinton. It's former Congressman Trey Gowdy, who's now reportedly joining the Trump legal team. He's on record loudly decrying the Obama administration for not turning over documents during the Benghazi investigation. So, I mean, I think for some people, it doesn't seem like there's much of a difference between these situations other than what party's in power.
Well, to my knowledge, the president has a transcript that was turned over almost immediately, and the whistleblower complaint, he immediately said, let's release that. There, obviously, whenever a president of the United States talks to another president, there's some stuff that's classified in there, particularly when it's the Ukraine and you got Russian separatists invading their country. But he gave lethal aid to these guys. They're obviously talking about stuff that's potentially classified.
On a different topic, I'm sure you saw the news today that Turkish forces started their incursion into Syria after President Trump said he would draw down the U.S. presence there. I know you're a U.S. Army combat veteran in Iraq and Afghanistan. What do you think? Did the president make a mistake?
He made a huge mistake. I think the Kurds are a huge ally. Many of them are in my district here in Tennessee. We've got Nashville has the largest Kurdish population in the country. They're great people. They've fought and bled with us. And, you know, pulling out of Syria is a bad idea.
Congressman, do you think the president runs a risk making so many of his Republican allies so incensed over this issue in Syria at the time when he needs their support during the impeachment process?
You know, I don't think, you know, Trump is not this guy who plays games like that. I mean, he does what he thinks is right every day, all day. So I don't think it's part of his calculations. You know, he made a campaign promise to get us out of Syria, and he feels like he's fulfilling it. I think it's the wrong decision. But from my perspective, Reagan had an old philosophy that if you're with me 80% of the time, you're with me. So, you know, I am disappointed in the decision on this one, but I still fully support the president.
That's a Republican Congressman Mark Green of Tennessee. Congressman, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
Okay, let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez for more on this. Franco, we just heard Congressman Green there with a strong defense of the administration, except for disagreeing, as many Republicans have, on what the president is right. doing with respect to Turkey and Syria, but on the issue of the impeachment inquiry, standing right by his side.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He's certainly following on that issue the Trump administration line. He's calling it a charade. It's very similar to the language that President Trump has used and other Republicans have used, who have called this a kangaroo court, saying that the Republicans don't have any rights. He noted something that a lot of the Republicans have wanted. The reason why they want – one of the reasons why they want to vote is if they get a vote, they can get some subpoena power. And that is something that Democrats are a little reluctant to give.
Well, let's talk about that. Why are the Democrats refusing to have a vote in the House, a formal vote, to open the impeachment inquiry?
Well, I mean, for one, they say they don't have to. They say it's unnecessary. Those reasons are political as well as practical. It's a lengthy process. You know, Pelosi doesn't want to put some members in a tough spot. You know, again, there's the subpoena power that Republicans want that Democrats don't want to give. Republicans want to call their own witnesses and fall for documents. That's what happened in the Nixon and Clinton impeachment hearings. But that's not something that the minority party usually has power of.
The White House, as we said, sent a letter to the House yesterday saying that their current efforts with regards to the impeachment inquiry are constitutionally invalid. How are Democrats responding to that refusal by the White House to participate?
They're hitting back hard. I mean, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accused Trump of trying to cover up his dealings with Ukraine. She accused him of trying to normalize lawlessness. She even warned the president very directly that, quote, you are not above the law. You will be held accountable. So very strong language.
Strong language. But is there anything that she can do at this point to get the White House to cooperate or to move forward with impeachment if they don't?
I mean, that she's trying to do everything she can. This is not just a legal battle. It's very much a political battle, as you presented in your interview with Mark Green. And this is trying to get to the, you know, the hearts and minds of the American people as well. And that's kind of something that both are trying to do as best they can.
There's an argument that's been made that the White House's non-cooperation with the Democrats actually could accelerate the impeachment proceedings. Explain that.
It certainly can. I mean, Democrats have repeatedly warned that any alleged stonewalling will only further evidence of obstruction, which is what Representative Adam Schiff, he's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said this week. What they're trying to use actually is Trump's own strategy of kind of blocking this against him. President Trump is obviously playing the political war, but this kind of resistance could work in the Democrats' favor, saying it's another example and reason for impeachment.
Franco, we were supposed to hear yesterday, or House Democrats were supposed to hear yesterday, from Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, was involved in some text messages that have come out since the investigation started into the president's call with the president of Ukraine. He didn't testify, wasn't deposed yesterday on Capitol Hill. The next one people are watching for is Marie Yovanovitch, who used to be the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine before President Trump removed her from that post in May. He called her bad news in that July call with Ukraine's president. Is she still maybe going to testify this week? And what do Democrats want to hear from her?
I mean, it's very unlikely that she's going to testify. She's, you know, as you point out, she's just one of the latest casualties of Trump's war, you know, on career diplomats. You know, House Democrats wanted to know about her conversations with top officials. What did she know about efforts by the administration to allegedly encourage the Ukraine government to investigate Joe Biden and his family? And was she told by State Department officials, as has been reported, that they could not shield her from attacks by the president and his allies?
Congress, by the way, comes back next week, right? They're currently on recess?
Yes.
Okay. So things you think will heat up next week when they come back?
I think there's no question that things are going to heat up. There are so many issues involved, not only the impeachment. You mentioned Syria. It's going to be a busy few weeks.
In terms of Syria, just briefly here, as we said, Turkey started moving into northern Syria. A lot of Republicans, including Congressman Green, against what the White House has done here in pulling back U.S. troops. What is the White House saying today?
Yeah, I mean, Trump really provoked a storm. You know, Trump has threatened to punish Turkey economically if it doesn't, if it does anything outside of what we think is humane or what they think is humane. However, as you pointed out, Republicans are really condemning this, including one of his great allies, Lindsey Graham,
right,
who says this could be the biggest regret of his presidency.
It's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez on another busy day in Washington. Franco, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks to $17 million in private funding, Johns Hopkins University has just launched the first center in the U.S. dedicated to the study of psychedelic substances. The center will explore how substances like LSD and psilocybin, commonly known as magic mushrooms, can treat a range of mental health problems, including addiction and depression. For more, we're joined by Dr. William Richards, a psychologist at Johns Hopkins and author of Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences. He's also one of very few people who started doing psychedelic research in the 1960s, watched the research trickle to a halt after the government declared psychedelics a Schedule I controlled substance in 1970, and then picked up the work again at the turn of the century. Dr. Richards, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with that $17 million investment. How big of a deal is that going to be for your new Center for Psychedelic Research?
Yes, it's a very big deal, and we're very thankful to have that kind of support in that 20 years ago we began from nothing. It's great to feel that respect and faith that people have in what we're doing.
And why do you think that's happening right now? And we should say that we're in a moment also when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration just approved a psychedelic called esketamine as a treatment for depression earlier this year.
That's right. And we are hoping the day will come in a few years where we will have sufficient data that they will feel good about approving psilocybin as well. And MDMA is close to approval also. So it may open up a whole new era in mental health treatment.
Well, and give us a sense of what you've seen, because you've been looking into this for decades now. What is the promise of psychedelics when it comes to treating mental health issues, addiction, depression, etc.?
The promise is immense from my perspective when the psychedelic substances are used intelligently, wisely, responsibly. There's some knowledge that has to go with it. You can't just give the drug like we give most medications. There has to be good screening and preparation and skillful guidance during the hours of drug action. It's a new concept, really, in the mental health world, because we're used to drugs like the antidepressants that you keep taking over and over and over and over. And that's helpful for some people, though they often have side effects and they often kind of suppress symptoms instead of really healing the symptoms or the getting at the cause of the distress. And the unique thing about these psychedelic substances is that they're often only administered once, maybe two or three times, and it is the memory of an experience that's healing. So you don't have to keep taking the drug again. You remember that something shifted in your view of yourself, your view of other people, your view of the world, your understanding of what it is to be a human being. And that's incredibly fascinating and powerful.
Well, tell me then how a session with a patient would work. If it could just be one experience with a psychedelic that is relieving to them in terms of whatever mental health issue they're dealing with, do they just come in, take the psychedelic, and then sit with you and talk with you, talk through issues, or how does it work?
Well, first, we always establish a really solid, trust-filled relationship with a therapist or guide, often through several meetings for a week or two before we administer the substance. And when we give them the psilocybin, it's done in a very confidential and comfortable, usually kind of a living room setting with very supportive music and a very safe, caring atmosphere, so that people feel free to just kind of sink into their minds, embrace whatever emerges, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant initially, and trust kind of the healing processes of their own minds. And the incredible thing about this research is how we encounter this wisdom within people's minds. Like, the human mind knows how to heal itself if you give it the trust-filled atmosphere and the opportunities to become deeply aware of the levels of consciousness within you. It's not always fun. It can be very painful at times, working through grief and guilt and confusion and so on. But it can be profoundly therapeutic in a very rapid space of time.
Well, one of the reasons why there hasn't been more research in this area is that psychedelics are listed as a Schedule I substance by the federal government. That means that the government considers them, quote, drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. What do you say in response to that? You've been dealing with that for decades now.
Well, I would say that arose out of the cultural change and fears back in the 1960s. It's distorted. It's inaccurate. I think we've already demonstrated a substantial positive effect of these substances for some groups of people. They're incredibly safe for most people. A few caveats there. If you're genetically programmed for severe mental illness, it might not be wise to take a psychedelic. If you have an acute heart condition, any intense emotion might be unwise, etc. But for most people, if they know what they're doing, these drugs are remarkably safe. They're not toxic. They're not addictive. And they can be profoundly helpful. Having said that, they can also be very frightening and disorienting for people who do not know what they're doing and aren't prepared or don't have the right dose of a pure substance. I like to use the metaphor of downhill skiing, you know. If you're going to do it, you ought to get some training before you jump on your skis and head down the double black diamond, you know? Mm-hmm. But we don't make skiing illegal because some people crash into trees.
What would you say is the most significant result of your work so far and the work that you and your colleagues have done over the past many decades?
That's hard to answer. I can tell you what motivates me most and what I hope will be the first legal application of psilocybin therapy is in palliative care, to help people who are approaching the end of their lives live fully with less anxiety and depression, closer interpersonal relationships. And in the work we've done with terminally ill people, those who have mystical experiences often claim loss of the fear of death. That somehow the fear gets displaced by kind of an curiosity. People live the final period of their lives much more fully and in healthy interaction with their families. And I would like to see the day come when that treatment is offered by the palliative care sections of many hospitals, and also for it to be covered by Medicare and insurance companies. And I think that's maybe right around the corner.
Dr. Richards, I want to ask you one more thing. There are probably some listeners who are hearing you talk about this and thinking, well, that's crazy that we would use psychedelics to treat these things. They're dangerous. They're, you know, what kind of person who's near the end of their life is going to want to take magic mushrooms or something like that? What would you say? I'm sure you've heard that. So
of
what
course.
Would you say to those people?
No, I mean, we have a major educational job to do. There's a lot of ignorance and prejudice in the population, including in very well-educated psychiatric circles. There were government pamphlets back in the 1960s that really were inaccurate. It was really propaganda. There's probably been no frontier in science that has been completely blocked for, what was it, 22 years. And now it's come alive again, and it's expanding dramatically throughout the United States and Western Europe. And it's the number of bright young professionals who are dedicated to this research frontier is absolutely amazing. And I hope to stick around to see it flourish, but I have no doubt that it will continue to expand whether I'm here or not. It's quite inspiring, actually.
That is Dr. William Richards, who is a psychologist at Johns Hopkins University, which just launched the first center in the U.S. dedicated to the study of psychedelic drugs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy, and all good wishes.
And your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
In California today, hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses are expected to go dark across the state. These are planned power outages, and PG&E, the largest utility in California, has already started shutting off electricity to some customers because of weather conditions. High winds have increased the risk of wildfires. Joining us now is KQED's Brian Watt in San Francisco. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And how widespread are these outages, and how much warning have people gotten?
Well, we started getting warnings from PG&E, the utility, about 2 days ago on Monday. And here in the Bay Area, in which we count nine counties, the outages that began phasing in at midnight local time were north of the Bay. Parts of Marin, Sonoma, Napa, and Solano counties. That's about 140,000 customers so far. But more outages are expected later today, closer to the Bay in parts of Alameda County, which is where Oakland and Berkeley are, Contra Costa County, and then south of the Bay, actually in the Silicon Valley area, San Mateo and Santa Clara County. So that's also the city of San Jose. All in all, across the state, it could get up to 800,000 customers.
Wow. And the reason, of course, is that PG&E is following a state-mandated plan for preemptive outages when there's a wildfire threat, but it's also meant to be a last resort kind of a measure. So what kind of threshold needs to be reached for this plan to kick in for so many people?
Well, PG&E isn't saying exactly what the weather threshold is, but their vice president of wildfire safety says that for these coming days, they have been forecasting a high stress scenario. That's the term he used, with wind gusts blowing anywhere from 25 to 65 miles an hour. And he said that these are the kinds of conditions that we had 2 years ago this week when those devastating fires north of the bay started. And this go round, it's even more intense conditions, but that are even more widespread regionally than those conditions were 2 years ago.
Is there evidence that turning the power off like this actually does help prevent the fires?
Well, the way we look at it is this, and I'm sure PG&E takes this into account. PG&E equipment is now believed responsible for more than a dozen wildfires in California, and that includes last year's Camp Fire, and we know how devastating that was in the town of Paradise. So while there are plenty of other things that can start a fire, someone has a campfire somewhere, grills out in a dangerous, sensitive area, if you shut the power down, the power lines down in sensitive areas, you're going to take a very, very big factor off the table. So I think that this is a extreme caution, but at least we eliminate one possibility.
And just very briefly, there are some reports that this could last for days. How are people planning to get through that?
Well, everyone's got their solution. You've got filling up gas tanks, putting stuff in the freezer. Don't open it until you know the power's back on. Mm. There are all kinds of strategies. You've got Cal Berkeley not having class today. There are various personal and institutional solutions for figuring this out.
What about you? Do you have power?
Well, I am staying in a part of Oakland that has power at the moment, but later today, it's in the zone that could lose power.
Good luck. KQED's Brian Watt in San Francisco. Thank you.
Thank you.
The impeachment inquiry into President Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president could hinge on whether President Trump's request to have Ukraine investigate Joe Biden amounts to a campaign finance violation. Joining us now to talk more about that is Trevor Potter, who's president of the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center. He is a Republican, former chair and member of the Federal Election Commission. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, and here's what the law states about contributions from a foreign citizen. It says it shall be unlawful for a foreign national, directly or indirectly, to make a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, or to make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in connection with a federal, state, or local election. Now, there's been a lot of talk about whether there was a quid pro quo. But isn't just the president asking the Ukrainian president for a favor involving his political rival, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter Biden, isn't that in itself illegal under campaign finance law?
The answer to that is yes. Obviously, that request has all sorts of other implications for foreign policy and the role of the president. But just looking at it narrowly as a campaign finance matter, what happened in that conversation is that the president, who is a candidate and has a campaign, asked a foreign government, which is included in the definition of a foreign national, for a favor, for help, in a way that would benefit his campaign, harm his opponent. And that is a classic case of requesting a expenditure and from a foreign national. And that would fit within the ban on soliciting foreign national contributions or taking anything of value. Here it's really the solicitation of them of something of value, which would be this international governmental investigation by the Ukrainian government.
Do you think that it would be argued that that's not a thing of value?
That, we're told by the press leaks, is the position that was taken by one branch of the Department of Justice. I think not so much that it's not a thing of value as that they were unsure how to value it. What is the estimated value? And that's relevant to justice because for a criminal investigation, they have thresholds to meet. Something has to be $2,500 or more for a misdemeanor offense, $25,000 or more for a felony offense. There are two aspects of that, though. One is you could have a violation of federal election law that's civil, not criminal, that would be pursued by the FEC without a threshold. Secondly, it's inconceivable that any sort of government investigation by the Ukrainian government wouldn't meet both of those thresholds. So it looks as if the Justice Department simply didn't want to get into valuing it and said, since we don't know how to value it, we're going to say this is not met. In their case, of course, they've got the double complication because they have a long-term policy that predates the Trump administration that says a president cannot be criminally charged while in office. And a sort of related question of does that mean he can't be criminally investigated while in office? So they had a real incentive to say, oh, no, 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 this is not a legal campaign finance violation because otherwise they're stuck with, well, what do we do with it?
Well, but in that case, then the campaign finance laws could never be violated by a sitting president who is going to be a candidate a lot of the time.
Well, the Justice Department position, I think, is that they could not be charged with a criminal violation while president, but they could be charged with it when they leave office, point one. And point two, certainly that the FEC has its own responsibility and is not covered by that Justice Department policy, and it could investigate it as a civil violation. That would require Justice to refer it to the Federal Election Commission. When they got the whistleblower complaint, there is no evidence that they have done that.
Well, and in fact, the Justice Department under Attorney General William Barr initially blocked Congress from receiving the whistleblower complaint against President Trump because, quote, there was no campaign finance violation and that therefore no further action was warranted.
Right. And if they are determining there is no campaign finance violation based on the idea that they can't value the thing of value that was requested, then they wouldn't refer it to the FEC because they would have had this fundamental view that the law wasn't broken here, which I think is wrong.
What about the bigger picture here, though? It seems like the U.S. does not prosecute campaign finance violations very often and that people can get away with things. We know that in 2013, the 2008 Obama campaign was fined $375,000 for fundraising reporting violations, one of the largest fines ever against a presidential campaign, but that was way after the election.
There is an underlying problem here, which is Congress created the FEC precisely to deal with what I would call sort of the garden variety campaign finance violations rather than criminalizing them. The problem we have is that the FEC has in recent years been very ineffective at this. It has been deadlocked on a partisan basis with the three Republican commissioners basically not wanting to enforce the law against either party, feeling that it's intrusive, I think not being committed to it philosophically. So they've prevented the commission from acting in many cases, even against Democrats.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the problems with enforcement. How common do you think violations are, campaign finance violations?
In my experience now going back a while, it's fairly common that there are what I'd call honest mistakes. You add up your numbers wrong. You put something in the wrong report. You don't take the efforts you're supposed to go find the correct names or occupations of your contributors required by law. I think it is much rarer that there is a organized attempt to violate the law. Unfortunately, the fact that the FEC is now ineffective, deadlocked, and by the way, currently doesn't even have a quorum, it takes four commissioners to act. And the fourth commissioner resigned about a month ago. So there are only three sitting there now. They actually legally cannot do anything. All of that raises, I think, the likelihood that someone will do something they know is impermissible on the basis that they're not going to be found out, they're not going to be pursued.
So back to where we are now, we talked about the president's phone call with the leader of Ukraine and him asking for a favor and that being, in your view and the view of many others, a campaign finance violation very clearly. there are other questions, too, including those involving the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and his role. What are you looking at there from a campaign finance violation point of view?
Well, I think his role here is really troublesome and very problematic because, first of all, he says he's representing the president personally. He's not a government official. He's not part of the State Department, so he's not filing any of the financial disclosure forms that a U.S. government representative would be required to file. As a result, we don't know who is paying him. He's a lawyer in private practice. He says he's not charging the president for any of this work, but he is reported on the public record to have a number of clients, including some Russians and some Ukrainians. So when he's over there working with the Ukrainian government and calling on the U.S. State Department to do things for him, who is he representing? Is he representing the foreign governments, foreign nationals? If he's representing the President of the United States in any sort of official way, then he ought to be a State Department temporary employee. They don't have to get paid to be that, but then they disclose what their sources of income are and who they're representing, and they'd have ethics obligations in terms of not representing somebody else while they are acting on behalf of the U.S.
So who's supposed to do something about that? The FEC, which doesn't have a quorum?
Well, that's of course, the first problem. It starts with the State Department, the State Department Inspector General, its ethics officers, but they're stuck with the fact that he claims not to be a State Department person. I think the answer is that the entity that will do something about that will be the House of Representatives in its current inquiry, where they will want to know who he was representing, who else he was representing, who was paying him for the activity we now know he was engaged in Ukraine.
That is Trevor Potter, former commissioner of the FEC and now president of the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Turkish armed forces have crossed the border into northern Syria to launch an offensive against the Kurds. Turkey's president says the mission is to prevent terror and bring peace to the area. The Kurds say today's airstrikes are causing panic among civilians. All of this comes just days after President Trump decided to withdraw U.S. troops from the region, abandoning Kurdish fighters who've been helping the U.S. turn back the Islamic State for years. Liz Sly of The Washington Post is stationed in Beirut. I spoke with her earlier today on Skype and asked if the Turkish strategy will be a full-out military operation.
We don't know, and I think the expectation is that most likely it would not be a full-on military operation, which could be very bloody and complicated. More likely to be a small snatching of maybe a small slice to sort of show that they've carried out their threat and gain a foothold. That's what everybody says is going to happen. And so at the moment, people are braced for it.
And what's the state of U.S. troops who had been working with the Kurds? These are the Syrian Democratic Forces that the Turks are supposedly going after. How many U.S. troops have pulled back from the border region and where have they gone?
Around 50 U.S. troops have pulled back from two small bases that they'd actually only established in the past year as part of an effort to negotiate a safe zone with Turkey in that border area. The realization that such a zone wasn't possible because it's not possible to make the Turkey and the Kurds safe in that area without a much bigger settlement prompted the pullout of those troops, according to Trump's instructions. Those 50 have moved back behind, away from the border, away from the area that Turkey is expected to target, and they're now further south with the other 1,000 U.S. troops in the area.
You and your colleague, Missy Ryan, at the Post have been reporting on the 20-plus prisons and detention camps that are currently under Kurdish control in this area that we've been talking about. Now, they're holding Islamic State fighters and their families. This will be a key strategic point in any coming military battle. What is the state of these camps and prisons ahead of a possible offensive?
Well, assuming that we do have a very limited incursion into those two points, there are no prisons in that area directly affected for now. If Turkey goes ahead with its plan to create a very large buffer zone that spans almost the whole border, then certainly some of those prisons will come under their control. At the moment, there isn't any effect on that. The Kurds have been threatening that they will pull out from those prisons if the Kurds come to go and fight the Turks. But I've got a feeling as well that they won't do that just because they are the first ones who ISIS would kill.
Hmm. And there's tens of thousands of people there.
There's tens of thousands of family members in a very large camp, quite considerably south to the area the Turks would attack. It's an extremely volatile area. Most of the families in this camp are not actually ISIS. They just want to get out and go back to their normal lives. But there's no screening process. And a number of the families in the camp are very, very militant ISIS members. Mm. And they've basically intimidated the other families living there and are kind of in danger of taking over the camp altogether. And again, the Kurds have warned that they might have to pull guys away from that camp. And so there is a danger of breakouts or possibly a rescue mission from ISIS sleeper cells in the area or something like that.
Well, the State Department has said that if the Turks move in, they will be responsible. The Turks will be responsible for guarding these prisons. Is that a realistic expectation?
Well, the Turks would presumably go to these prisons. I think the worry is that would there be any organized handover? Probably not. These guys could potentially escape. If the Turks took the prisons, well, we don't know what they'd do with them. There is a small way, but I've talked to several diplomats from the countries who have people there, and they haven't quite got ahead to this point yet. If there was a managed handover, it might actually be easier to get these people back to their countries if Turkey was in the area, just because the remoteness of this area and the fact that it's a war zone means that most countries don't want to send people out there to get their people out of prison and to escort them back to their countries. Mm. But if Turkey were to escort them to Ankara, to Turkey, where all these countries have embassies and consular facilities, it could change the picture quite a lot. But nobody's jumping ahead that far yet because the initial incursion is unlikely to affect any prisons.
President Trump has said many times that the Islamic State is defeated, and that's one of the reasons why he's willing to pull U.S. troops out of the region. U.S. security officials don't necessarily agree with the president at all. And you mentioned in a recent report that there's an audio recording from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. What does that suggest to you?
Yes, ISIS is defeated on the ground, but their networks and structures and organizational structures have not been dismantled. So there's always a danger of a comeback. And the Americans are playing quite a big role at the moment with the SDF and also with the Iraqi security forces across the border in trying to stamp out those residual networks. They are capturing financiers, attacking small cells, picking up suspects. So it's a sort of policing operation, but it's also a sort of mopping up operation. And it's clear that there is a potential for ISIS to make a comeback if there is a sudden surge of instability or just simply a vacuum of security.
That's Liz Sly with the Washington Post. She's in Beirut. Liz, thanks for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.